17. The Moonbase Alpha dining hall was a long, rectangular room containing four circular tables made of brushed steel, flanked by matching benches bolted to the floor. Several modular food and beverage dispensers were embedded in one long wall, along with a few microwaves, but no replicator, as far as I could tell. The opposite wall was dominated by a large curved window that provided a stunning view of the massive Daedalus impact crater spread below us, like a monochromatic Grand Canyon. As promised, an extravagant meal was already laid out on the tables, ready and waiting for us. What looked like more than enough food for several Thanksgiving dinners. One of the steel tables was covered with a silk tablecloth and set with eight place settings, complete with silver cutlery and fine bone china, and off to the side stood a row of four aethids standing at silent attention, ready to serve us. A paper tuxedo was taped to each of their chest plates. I took the last empty seat, between my father and Milo. Graham sat next to Debbie, and only then did I realize from their body language that the two of them were crushing on each other in a big way. Milo noticed it too, and rolled his eyes, then nudged me and nodded at the two of them, then at Chen and Wodey, who were both making furtive eye contact too. "This is just great," he grumbled under his breath. "Here I thought I was being recruited for an epic space adventure, but it turns out I'm a guest star on Love Boat The Next Generation." "Set course for romance," Shin quoted, doing such a perfect Patrick Stewart impersonation that Milo and I both laughed out loud. Everyone began to pass dishes and serve themselves food, everyone except Debbie, who bowed her head and began to mumble silently to herself in prayer. We all froze for an awkward beat, then bowed our heads in solidarity until she finished. Even with all of that delicious-looking food in front of me, I still didn't seem to have any appetite. But the day's bizarre events appeared to have left everyone else ravenous, and for a while they were all too busy stuffing their faces to talk. I cast a few sideways glances at my father, but he was shoveling food into his mouth robotically while avoiding eye contact with me. Chen was the one who broke the silence. "My phone is still not functioning," he said via his QCOM's translator. "When will I be allowed to call home and speak to my family?" My father checked the time on his own QCOM. "An hour before the Vanguard is expected to reach us," he said. "That's when the leaders of every nation around the world will break the news to their citizens. Once the cat is out of the bag, you'll be able to call home. We won't have long to talk, I'm afraid."
"Why is the EDA waiting until the last minute to tell everyone about the invasion?" Wodey asked. "That won't give the world much time to prepare for the Vanguard's attack."
"The world is already as prepared as it's ever going to be," my father said. Shin nodded. "The population is already beginning to panic. Judging by what's on the global news feeds, people all over the world saw those EDA shuttles with their own eyes this morning when they were flying around to pick up essential recruits. The media has been airing and analyzing footage all day, along with information about their connection to Chaos Terrain's video games. The whole world wants to know what's really going on." My father shook his head. "No, they don't," he said. "Once people find out about the invasion, chaos will spread like wildfire. Civilization will start to break down." Graham made a derisive sound. "The EDA knows people will be more likely to stand their ground and fight if they don't have time to turn tail and run for the hills." I looked at my father. He briefly met my gaze, then glanced over at Debbie, who was staring down at the countdown clock on her QCOM. It was superimposed over a photo she'd set as her display background. Three smiling, dark-haired boys, resting their chins on the edge of a swimming pool in the bright sunshine.
"Handsome boys," Graham said.
"Thank you," she replied. "I'm worried about them."
Then she reached out and covered the countdown clock with her finger so she could still see her son's faces.
"What about you two?" Debbie asked, addressing Shin and Graham. "Is the EDA going to let you contact your families too?"
"I'm a bit nervous about that, actually," Graham said. "Me mum's still alive, but she thinks I died back in the 90s. My father had already passed by the time I was recruited, so I left her all alone, and she's been alone ever since. The EDA has taken care of her financially, of course, but emotionally, well, what can one do? Graham blinked a few times, then swallowed hard. I hope she still recognizes me, he said. And if she does, I hope the sight of me doesn't give her a coronary. That is, if the PM's address doesn't do that first. He shook his head. The poor old girl is in her 60s now. I wasn't all that worried about how my own mother would react to the news our planet was being invaded. She had always been the picture of calm in the face of crisis. She seemed to thrive on it. But when she found out my father was still alive, well, that was another story.
And you, Shin? Debbie asked quietly. Do you have any family, dear?
Shin's smile faded slightly. Unfortunately, my parents both passed away years ago, about halfway through my tour of duty up here. So I never got to say goodbye to them, which was extremely painful at the time. Then his expression brightened and he reached over and gave my father's shoulder a squeeze before slapping him on the back. But my friend Xavier here had already gone through the same thing, and he helped me get through it. He lost his folks too, a few... Shin cut himself off, then shot a nervous glance over at me and then my father, who was again staring intently at the tablecloth. Anyway, Shin said, forging ahead. Right now I'm just thankful they got to live out their lives peacefully, and that they're not around for what's about to happen. Everyone around the table nodded, save for my father, who seemed to be slowly turning to stone. Shin seemed to sense this, and he turned to me. How you doing, Zack? He said. You holding up okay? I nodded. Then I shook my head. Then I shrugged and shook my head again. Don't look so worried, Shin said. The general forgot to mention one thing during his little pep talk earlier. He gave me a conspiratorial smile. We have a secret weapon. The greatest drone pilot who ever lived. He jerked a thumb at my father. Did you know that your old man has shot down over 300 enemy ships? He currently holds the EDA record. Your father has also been awarded the Medal of Honor 3 times by 3 different presidents. Shin said. Bet you didn't know that, did you? He shook his head at my father. He's too modest to even tell his own son.
Seriously? I asked him. 3 Medals of Honor?
My father nodded, closing his eyes to his embarrassment, the same way I did when I received compliments. They were classified Medals of Honor, my father said. It's not like anyone will ever find out about them. I just did, I said. Mom will, too, when I get a chance to tell her. He gave me a half smile, then dropped his eyes again. My mother would be proud of him, but that might not be enough, and he knew it. I could see it in the defeated look that flashed across his face whenever I mentioned her. My father knew as well as I did that all of his noble motivations and heroic sacrifices might not be enough to win her forgiveness, or even her understanding, for what he'd done to us. Not in the limited amount of time she would have to do so. I still wasn't sure if I had forgiven him. I glanced over at my father. I knew he wasn't planning to call my mother, but I'd do it for him if I had to. I wasn't sure what he was supposed to say to her after disappearing for 17 years. I didn't know what I was going to say when we spoke, and I'd just seen her earlier that morning, or if she'd be willing to listen. But I had to try. When Wodey finished eating a moment later, she got up from the table and went over to the observation window, then spent a moment staring down at the radio dish nestled inside the enormous crater far below.
What did you say that thing was again? She asked.
That's the Daedalus Observatory, Shin said, with a tinge of pride in his voice. It's the largest radio telescope ever built, by humans at least.
We built it to talk to the aliens?
Wodey asked. Shin nodded. This crater is near the center of the moon's far side, so this location is completely shielded from all of the radio interference created by humans, which makes it an ideal place to send and receive radio transmissions without them being monitored back on Earth. He sighed. Unfortunately, the Europans have never been interested in talking.
One of the first acts of the EDA, Graham said, was to create an internal task force called the Armistice Council, made up of a bunch of prominent scientists, including Carl Sagan. I've been wondering about that, I said, interrupting him. How did they get Carl Sagan to keep the Europans a secret for so long? He knew the news would create a worldwide panic and upend our civilization, my father said. He only agreed to remain silent on the condition that the EDA give him the funding necessary to educate the world's population and try to prepare them for the news that humanity is not alone. That was how he got funding for his Cosmos television series. Shin nodded. Unfortunately, Dr. Sagan passed away before things really began to escalate with the Europans. The Armistice Council kept on trying to establish peace talks after he died, Graham added, but the squids never sent a single reply. Squids, I repeated. I thought we didn't know anything about the Europans' biology. That's the official story, all right, Graham said, adopting a conspiratorial tone. But trust me, mate, they're squids. The brass knows a lot more about our enemy than they let on. They always have. He glanced at Shin, then at my father, then back at me. What are you talking about? Milo asked. The Europeans declared war on us for no reason. Everyone had given up on correcting Milo every time he referred to the Europeans as Europeans, even poor Graham, who actually was European. That's the official story, all right, Graham said. But does it make any sense? Think it through. If the Europeans had attacked us 10 or 20 or even 30 years ago, we never would have been able to stop them. I sat bolt upright, then glanced at my father, but his eyes were locked on Graham. We couldn't even have stopped an asteroid or a meteor from wiping us out back then, much less an angry alien species with vastly superior weaponry and technology, Graham continued. They had the upper hand from the start, so why didn't they use it? Instead, they basically just handed us their technology, then gave us all the time in the world to reverse engineer it. Then they gave us even more time to build a huge stockpile of millions of drones to defend ourselves against the drones they were building. It was more than a little disturbing to hear Graham vocalize many of the same questions that had been eating away at me ever since the EDA briefing. And they built all of their ships and drones in orbit above Europa in plain view of Galileo's cameras. There's no way they weren't aware that we were watching them. They wanted us to see. It was like they were running a non-stop, year-round episode of How It's Made by Aliens. Graham noticed that Shin was now making a screw-loose gesture with his index finger and flipped him the bird as he kept on talking. The Europeans had this huge advantage over us, but then they slowly, gradually lessened it on purpose instead of just slaughtering us over a weekend. Why? Why send a small group of scout ships every year, year after year, to study us, mutilate our cattle, and attack our secret moon base? He lowered his voice to a whisper. But they weren't really even serious attacks. They never tried to destroy the entire base or kill everyone inside during their annual Jovian opposition assaults. Instead, they always do just enough damage to prove that they could destroy the whole base if they wanted to. Then they leave without actually doing it. Why? Shin interrupted him again. Are you going to let him spout this nonsense in front of the new recruits? He asked my father. Right before the attack? He'll demoralize them. My fellow recruits did indeed seem shaken by Graham's speech, as was I, but for a different reason. Everything he'd laid out matched my own suspicions with eerie accuracy. But I didn't want to hear it. Shin was right. Worrying about abstractions and unanswerable questions just hours before the fight of our lives was a pointless, even harmful distraction. You can't stop the signal, pal, Graham said. I've also heard from several reliable sources that one of their scout ships crashed in Florida in the late 80s, only it wasn't a drone. They recovered it with two dead European pilots floating inside a pressurized fishbowl cockpit. Word is, we've still got the bodies on ice in a bunker 5 miles beneath Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. He's just repeating old rumors, Shin said. Alliance gossip. Bullshit stories that have been circulating through the ranks for decades. There's no evidence to support any of it. That's not true, and you know it, Shinbone, Graham said. Why do you think the Sobrakai were designed to be aquatic extremophiles in the Chaos Terrain games? Because that's how the Europans really look, man. He turned to address me and the other new arrivals. The Sobrakai Overlord's design was based on the biology of the real Europans. They just scaried him up for the public.
Well, it worked, Debbie said. I have nightmares about that Overlord whenever I forget to skip the intro and mistakenly catch a glimpse of him. It, I mean.
Once again, I'm afraid the graham cracker over there is talking directly out of his ass, Shin told us. We have no idea if they're cephalopods or not. That's just a best guess based on their current habitat. In reality, we don't even know if they're carbon-based or if they're even indigenous to Europa. He smiled at Debbie. Don't worry, he said. The Overlord is made up. He was invented by Chaos Terrain to give the enemy a face. A villainous, slightly humanoid alien that humanity could rally against. Like Bing the Merciless, or Darth Vader, or Zod, or... I get the idea, Debbie said. She shook her head. For some reason, not knowing what they look like at all is even more terrifying. Wodey and Milo both nodded. I glanced at my father again, but he was studying my face, as if trying to gauge my reaction to what I was hearing.
Do you believe any of this stuff, General? Debbie asked him.
He hesitated a moment and exchanged looks with Graham before finally breaking his silence. I'm far more skeptical about those rumors than Graham, he said. However, I don't entirely agree with Shin's straightforward assessment of things either. He glanced at me. We've all had our share of arguments about this, with Admiral Vance as well. We all interpret the limited data we have in a drastically different way. He smiled faintly. Part of being human, I guess.
You didn't answer the question, General, Wodey pointed out. What do you believe?
Yes, General, Shin said. His tone was suddenly derisive. Why don't you be honest and tell them the truth? Tell your son the truth about your theory. That should really give morale an added boost around here, just before 0 hour. Shin dropped his silverware onto his plate with a loud clatter, got up from the table and walked out of the mess hall. My father watched him go. Graham shrugged and continued eating. The three of us have been arguing this subject for years, he said. Our differences in opinion were bound to come to a head today. Shin's just under an enormous amount of stress right now, my father said. We all are.
What was he talking about? I asked. About your theory?
My father sighed and glanced at the others, who were all watching him intently, including Graham. Nearly everyone in the EDA at the command level agrees with Graham, in that the Europans' behavior and tactics over the past 42 years raise a lot of questions, at least from a human perspective. He shook his head. The problem is that no one has ever been able to agree on how to interpret them. Most of the people in command, people like Admiral Vance, lost interest in trying to communicate with the Europans after they began sending drones here to attack us. Damn straight, I said, they declared war on us.
True, he said. But what if the Europans waited until now to attack, because they have a hidden motive, one we still can't ascertain? Maybe we've misinterpreted their actions, or maybe they've misinterpreted ours.
What the fuck is there to misinterpret? I heard myself ask. They're coming to kill us all, just like they've been promising to do since before any of us were born. The time for negotiating is past, don't you think?
My father shrugged. He looked cornered. I don't know, son, he said. Maybe.
I stood up. Maybe? Did you say maybe?
Calm down, Zach, my father said. Let's talk this through.
I've heard enough talk, General, I said. Shin is right. You're supposed to be leading us into battle and inspiring us, not dumping all your own fear on us.
My accusation seemed to detonate on his face like a bomb. His features began to contort, but I turned my back on him so I wouldn't have to see the rest of his reaction. I walked out of there as fast as I could without looking back. When I finally stopped walking a few minutes later, I realized I was lost. So I pulled up the interactive map of the base on my QCOM and used it to locate the nearest turbo elevator. I wrote it down to the habitation level,
and then returned to where the living quarters were located. When I reached my room, I pressed my palm to the onyx panel beside the door, and it slid open. The lights came on as I stepped inside. The interior looked like a dorm room at Starfleet Academy. It had a symmetrical two-occupant layout, with a loft bed on either side, each enclosed in a transparent, soundproofed box that could be blacked out with the touch of a button for privacy. Each loft also had a built-in ladder, dresser, and uniform closet, and there was a large, flat-screen television monitor embedded in the ceiling directly over each bed. There was also a small computer hutch beneath each bunk, with an ergonomic chair bolted to the floor. My backpack was sitting nearby. I sat down at the computer, and its built-in monitor lit up, displaying a desktop with EDA logo wallpaper and a few program icons. I took out the flash drive my father had given me and plugged it in. I held my breath as the file list popped up. There were hundreds of text files saved on the drive, along with dozens of video files, all with similar file names. Dear Zach, followed by a 6-digit numerical date. The first file was named Dear Zach 100900.txt, October 9th, 2000, a few days after my father was supposed to have died.
Dear Zach, I'm not even sure how to start this letter. So much has happened in the past few days, and most of it still doesn't seem real. I'm writing you this letter from the moon. For real, kiddo, your dad is on the moon. You see, I didn't really die in an explosion at the plant like they told you and your mom. The government just made it look like I had died, because they need my help to fend off an alien invasion. I know that sounds ridiculous, like something out of a science fiction paperback or a late-night movie, but there's a reason for that. Star Wars, Star Trek, all of those sci-fi movies, novels, TV shows, and video games I've been playing my whole life, they were all designed to prepare the people of the world for a real alien invasion. I'm still trying to wrap my head around it, but I know it's true. I've already seen the evidence with my own eyes. We still don't know when the invasion will begin, so I'm not sure how long I'll have to be away from you and your mom. Maybe it will only be a few months. But it could be years before I'm able to come back home. There's also a chance I might get killed up here. If that happens, I don't want you to spend the rest of your life believing your dad was just some loser sewage worker who died in a stupid accident before he ever did anything important with his life. I want you to know who I really was and what really happened to me. But more than anything, I need you to know how hard it was for me to leave you and your mom, and how hard it is now to know you both think I'm dead. Please know that I never would have put either of you through all of this if I felt like there was any other choice. The government has promised to take care of my family while I'm away. They set up some sort of fake settlement for the accident, so you and Mom should never have to worry about money. You'll be able to live a lot more comfortably than the three of us ever could have on a sewage worker's salary, that's for sure. I know it won't make up for me being gone, but it does make me feel a little better. I really miss both of you, but I have to admit that it's also kind of amazing up here. My whole life I felt like I was destined to do something important, but I was only ever good at video games, which I always figured would be completely useless. But it's not useless, and neither am I. I think this is what I was always destined to do with my life. I just never knew it. My whole existence is classified now, so I'm not even allowed to send you birthday cards while I'm away. But I'm still going to write you as often as I can, and I'll save the letters until I can give them to you. I'm going to write your mom, too. It's only been a few days, but I already miss both of you a lot. I hope you're both doing okay, and I hope my funeral wasn't too hard on your mom or you, even though you're not even a year old yet, so you won't remember being there. But she will, and thinking about how hard that must have been for her makes me feel like jumping off a cliff. Of course, I realize now I already jumped. That's why I'm stuck up here now. Anyway, I promise to write again soon when I have more time. I'll tell you about everything that has happened to me and all about this moon base where I live. But right now, I have to go defend Earth from alien invaders. Love, Xavier, your dad. I kept on reading, devouring letter after letter. His early letters filled in missing details of the story I'd already pieced together from reading his old theory notebook. My father described in detail how he'd begun to uncover facets of the EDA's grand conspiracy in the years before they recruited him, after his encounter with the strange Phaeton game at his local arcade. He would later learn that the same prototype was used to recruit Shin, Graham, and Admiral Vance. After he was inducted, my father's longtime suspicions were confirmed. The EDA had been tracking him ever since he was in grade school. He'd been moved to the top of their watch list after he'd mailed in dozens of fuzzy Polaroids of his record-high scores to Activision. But the EDA deemed him ineligible for early recruitment due to some, quote, troubling results in the preliminary psych evaluation they did on him. That was why they didn't actually recruit my father until much later, when he was 19, shortly after he became a father. One morning, two men in black suits showed up during his lunch break and abducted him from his job. They took him to one of their secret installations and showed him an earlier version of the EDA briefing film I'd been shown, and gave him a choice. He could either join the EDA and use his video game skills to try to help save humanity, or he could, as he said, puss out and keep wading through sewage for a living until aliens show up and destroy our planet, along with my wife, my baby boy, and everyone else I know and love. What choice did I have, Zach? I didn't want to leave you two, but I couldn't just sit around and do nothing while that happened. So I said yes, even though I knew it meant I might never see you and your mother again. If I died protecting the two of you and our home, then I figured it would be worth it. Imprisonment. That was what he began to call it. In every letter I opened, my father repeated the same apologies, marking and lamenting every single missed birthday or Christmas. For him, every milestone of my childhood and adolescence had been a double-edged sword. Watching me grow to manhood brought him joy, even from such a great distance, but that joy was always tinged with the bitter agony he felt at having missed every last second of it, and the knowledge of the pain caused by his absence. Once a month, he wrote, the EDA would send him updates about my mother and me. He looked forward to them like holidays. In the interim, he scoured the internet for any additional scrap of news about us he could find in a local paper or on my school's website. Every time he received a new photo of me, he wrote about it in his letters in endless detail, going on and on about how big I was getting, about how much he'd missed me and my mom more and more every year. He wrote to me about his day-to-day life as an elite Moonbase Alpha drone pilot. He recounted the details of the battles he fought each year during the Jovian opposition. He wrote about his hopes for victory and about his fear of the coming war. My father used that phrase often in his letters, the coming war. It made me realize how terrible it must have been for him to have this conflict hanging over his head all these years. He had lived his whole adult life with this terrible burden, knowing that the end of everything was coming and that it was drawing closer every second. In one letter, he confessed that he'd stopped dreading the coming invasion. Now I long for it to begin, he wrote, because, one way or another, it will put an end to my misery and my imprisonment here. He wrote, I miss you and your mother so much. I can barely stand it sometimes. And then, half a dozen letters later, he wrote, I just can't stand it anymore. Another letter said he'd gone a little nuts for a while. He wrote about how they put him on antidepressants. When things got really bad, he took tranquilizers sometimes, too. And he was required to video conference with a shrink back on Earth twice a week. He wrote that they kept giving him medals, but they no longer meant anything to him. He just wanted to go home. But he couldn't, because it was his job to make sure humanity still had a home when this was all over. Besides, he knew the EDA wouldn't let him go home now anyway, because he'd asked them repeatedly. But they told him he was far too valuable an asset,
and that the world needed him right where he was. So instead, he'd started to beg the EDA to give him just a few hours of shore leave so he could visit his family and remember what it was he was up here fighting for. They told him that would be too big of a security risk, and that if anyone learned he was still alive, especially his family, it could jeopardize everything he had worked for and sacrificed for all of these years. As difficult as it had been for me to grow up without knowing my father, I now realized that the years we'd spent apart had been even more difficult for him. For the past 17 years, I'd been living an idyllic life in the suburbs with Mom, surrounded by friends and all of the comforts of home. My father had spent those years here, in this desolate place on the far side of the moon, all alone, and for all he knew, completely forgotten by his loved ones. Finally, I got curious and jumped ahead to the collection of video messages he'd recorded. I clicked on the most recent one, dated less than a week ago. The timestamp said it was just after 2 o'clock in the morning by MBA time. My father was sitting in a large, dark room, larger than his quarters. It was some part of the base I didn't recognize. His unshaven face was just inches from his QCOM, and his paranoid, bloodshot eyes filled half of the video frame. As he sat there in the dark, rambling into his QCOM's video camera, he looked and sounded just like a raving, straitjacketed asylum patient. More specifically, a lot like Brad Pitt in 12 Monkeys. "There's something I have to do," he said. "Something I can't tell you about until I see you in person, but I don't know if Vance will really honor my request and station you up here with me. If he doesn't, I need you to know something." He stared into the camera lens, seeming to search for the right words. "What if figuring out the aliens' true motives is the only way to beat them?" He shrugged and glanced away. "Or at least survive them? At this point, I think surviving might be humanity's best-case scenario." He looked back into the lens. "I hope all of this makes sense to you, if and when you actually ever get to see it. If you do, please forgive me, son, for everything. And no matter what people call me, no matter what they say about my own actions, I want you to know that I did what I felt I had to do to protect you and your mom and everyone else back on Earth. Please know that I did what I did because I didn't think I had any other choice. If you're still alive to see this message, you'll know I made the right one." He stared expectantly at the camera for a few more seconds, as if he actually expected someone to respond. Then he tapped the screen in front of him, and his image winked out. I yanked out the flash drive and pocketed it. Then I knelt to grab my EDA rucksack. My old canvas backpack was stuffed inside, along with my father's old patch-covered leather jacket. I slung the pack over my shoulder, then continued out the exit. I walked down the empty corridor to my father's quarters. The door hissed open for me automatically as soon as I came within range of its retinal scanner, and I saw my father sitting in a chair in the corner of the room, strapped into an Armada interceptor flight control system like the one I had at home. He was wearing VR goggles and a pair of noise-canceling headphones and didn't appear to notice me come in. I could tell that he was playing an Armada practice mission with Shin and Milo because he kept saying their call signs, followed by his trademark red drive catchphrase, which he uttered each time he blasted one of his opponent's ships to virtual smithereens. "You're welcome, you're welcome, oh, and you're quite welcome, too." I cleared my throat loudly, and he pulled off his goggles and headphones. I held up his flash drive. He nodded and stood up. Then he glanced over his shoulder at the nearest security camera before turning back to me. "Let's go," he said. "I know a place we can talk in private."